Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 74. Cancer and Aging, Rival Demons, with Dr. Judith Campisi. This episode of Futures in Biotech is brought to you by Kaleidograph, a thoughtfully designed graphing and data analysis application for research scientists, as well as those in business and engineering fields. Try Kaleidograph for 45 days, risk-free, and receive a 20% discount if you purchase Kaleidograph within the next 60 days. Visit www.synergy.com/podcast.htm for more details. And by MailRoot. MailRoot is a secure, hosted email filtering service that you can have up and running in minutes. There's no hardware or software to install. Just sign up, change your MX record, and you're protected. TWiT listeners get a 10% discount for life. Sign up today for a 15-day free trial at mailroot.info.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there able to get the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
It's potentially one of the things that like rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun's the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare it to our closest evolutionary relative.
So today's episode on Futures in Biotech, we're going to cover the biology of aging. This is a second part. The second of a three-part series that we're doing, interviewing scientists from the Buck Institute for Research in Aging, which is in Novato, California, just down the turnpike from the TWiT Cottage. So we are very, very fortunate to have Dr. Judith Campisi. Her work is really at the nexus of aging and cancer. And she's made really important strides elucidating mechanisms of cellular aging, genome stability, and anti-cancer genes, or tumor suppressors as we call them. She received her PhD in biochemistry from the State University of New York in Stony Brook and postdoctoral training at Harvard Medical School. She holds a joint appointment at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, where she's a senior scientist. She received several awards for pioneering work on cellular senescence and aging, and most recently was designated a laureate of the Ipsen Foundation and winner of the Ipsen 2010 Longevity Prize. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'd like to quickly introduce our guest host. It's Dr. Simon Melov, and he's an associate professor at the Buck Institute, and doing this series was his idea, and I really appreciate him coming on because he's a true subject matter expert on the field.
Welcome great to be here.
Wow. And you've got great audio. You guys are at the cottage. I am so excited. This is really cool to have a big presence there. So let's start off. I suppose I read several reviews last night and really understanding the nexus between cancer and aging. Well, I didn't say I understood them completely. Or perhaps you could... cellular senescence seems to be the primary focus of your work. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
That's right.
What is it?
You want me to explain what it is?
down to the atom, actually.
I think it's, you know, the best way to think about cellular senescence is that it's a stress response. And it exists primarily to prevent a cell that's in danger of becoming a cancer cell from proliferating. So if a cell can't proliferate, if a cell can't make more of itself, it cannot go on to form a tumor. So it's a very potent mechanism for keeping cancer at bay, which it does for quite a long time, 50 years in the case of humans. So it's quite remarkable. And it's an interesting process because unlike another anti-tumor mechanism called apoptosis, which is a process whereby cells commit suicide, they die, senescent cells don't die. They linger in the body. And what we found is there's a cost to, an evolutionary cost, to having these two very potent tumor suppressor mechanisms. And that cost is aging. Later on in life, we develop symptoms that we think these two processes now begin to drive, symptoms that we recognize as aging and age-related disease. So the challenge for people like me and my colleagues who study both of these mechanisms, the cell death mechanism and the senescence mechanism, is to try to keep the good parts of those anti-tumor effects, but either bypass or eliminate the deleterious effects of what happens when these processes begin to mount as they do during aging.
So cellular senescence, if I understand it, is a biological mechanism that says, okay, the cell has reached or attained a certain level of growth period. It's now time to prevent its continuous division? Or is this beyond that?
It's more than that. So every time a cell divides, there's a danger of that cell picking up a mutation in its DNA. Going through cell division is very dangerous for cells because 3 billion base pairs of DNA need to be replicated without a mistake. And there are enzymes that do that, and the enzymes are pretty good, but they're not perfect. And so cell division...
I'm just saying few, because I'm glad there are those enzymes that prevent us from...
Yes.
Okay.
So they're pretty good enzymes, and they work pretty well, but they're not perfect. And so going through a round of cell division puts the cell in danger of picking up a mutation. So what's wrong with that? Well, it's mutations that drive cancer, and eventually a cell will pick up enough mutations, and that cell then becomes at risk for developing into a tumor. So these two mechanisms, either programmed cell death or programmed suicide, or simply shutting down the apparatus that allows a cell to divide, are two ways that have evolved to try to suppress the development of cancer from cells that are in danger of becoming cancerous. And I do want to emphasize, these are really good things to have. We have mouse models. We have some sad accidents of humans born with defects in the genes that control these two processes. And we know what happens. These mutations that knock out the ability to die or undergo senescence give rise to people with premature cancer. They get cancer at a very young age. So there's a good side to them. And what we've discovered, though, is that especially in the case of cellular senescence, there's a downside. And the downside is these cells don't die. They're stable. They stick around in the body. And probably even more interesting from a basic biological point of view is they begin to secrete molecules that alter the tissue in which these cells find themselves. And those changes are changes that we know occur with age in tissues. And so our major hypothesis is that the presence of these cells is a driving force behind late life pathology, late life changes that we recognize as aging.
Can I jump in here, yeah, Judy, and just follow up on something you said about cell number? I mean, what you said about each time a cell divides, that's a dangerous time.
Yeah.
Is there any implications to that with regards to organism size and longevity? And or resistance to cancer. I mean, you know, blue whale is 2,500 times the size of a human being, presumably a lot more cell division.
And also starts with a single cell,
right,
just like us.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Actually, very little is known about that. It has been hypothesized, and there's probably some validity to this hypothesis, that the larger an organism is, the more stringent its anti-cancer mechanisms have to be. And so... For elephants to not only grow to such a large size, but to live such a long time, they have to have very superior tumor suppressor mechanisms. So we don't really know what they are, but we do know differences between mice and humans. So we know it down at the other end. So mice live about 3 years. They're tiny little animals. And we know that they are much less capable of mounting these anti-tumor responses than human cells. Cells from a mouse are less well equipped to suppress cancer than cells from a human.
And let me ask you... Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Simon.
Okay. I was going to say, in following up on that, I mean, is that to do with really just overall their defenses are are less efficient at repairing damage, or is it actually their repair is not as good as longer lived organisms?
What was the first alternative?
Well, they're just the fidelity of replication is not as good, or is their repair actually worse?
They're probably my mouse cells are worse at repairing certain types of lesions than human cells. It's a little bit complicated because you may know that there are genes that orchestrate how repair will be carried out, and it turns out that there are some DNA repair genes that are primed to be expressed instantly when there's damage in humans, and those genes are not primed to have such a robust response in, say, a mouse cell. So there are differences between mice and humans and how they repair the DNA. But there's also differences in the way they handle the initial damage. So humans are better at fighting off oxygen, which is a major cause of damage in human and mouse cells.
I'm wondering...
Yes.
This is such a fundamental question about life, right? I always wonder, why does a German Shepherd only live to the age of 12 to 14?
Yes.
And yet they still get, some considerably good medicine. It's not like they don't have antibiotics available to them. And people take care of their animals, yet they're destined for death. And we're not that far off genetically.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is one of the big mysteries in the biology of aging. What is it that dictates lifespan? Think of a mouse and a human. Mice live 3 years. We live, if we're lucky, we'll live 100 years or maybe more. And our genes are 97% identical. So there's 3% of the genome that must dictate lots of things, including whether you have a long, skinny tail and pointy ears. And it really is, I think, still one of the big fundamental mysteries in biology is what are the genes that actually set the pace at which an organism will age? We'd love to know the answer. We don't.
Do you think senescence is... senescence is one of the major components?
It is. We think it is a major component, but I don't want to oversimplify the problem. We think that the ability to fight off cancer is one of the things that drives aging. I would never say it's the only thing that drives aging, but we think that if we could get a handle on how to dampen the deleterious effects of senescent cells, we may not change lifespan in humans, but we think for sure we would be able to improve what we call health span, years of healthy life. As you know, most people, when they live to be very old, they spend the last decade of their life disabled, and it's a huge burden, human burden, and it's a huge economic burden. And much of that is caused by this low-level decline in tissue function, and we know that some of the molecules that senescent cells make are capable of causing sort of low-level systemic decline in tissue function.
Let me ask you, let me just put this question forth, because it raises the, how did senescence become a biological question? I mean, how was it discovered? If it's just cells, sort of saying the timing is over and now there's a new set of biological events, so it's like a milestone for a cell. How was it discovered?
Right. Like all great discoveries, it was discovered by accident. So it was discovered by a man who lives not too far from here named Len Hayflick. And Len Hayflick was trying to grow viruses in human cells for making vaccines. And he noticed that routinely he would take human cells and they'd grow just fine in tissue culture dishes, petri dishes, for a while, and then they'd stop. And at the time that he made that discovery, it flew in the face of what people thought they knew about cells. So prior to Len Hayflick, the field was dominated by work from a very brilliant transplant surgeon named Alexis Carrel. And Carrel basically discovered that he could take a chicken heart and dissociate it into individual cells and put those cells in culture, and those cultures would just go on and divide and divide and divide and divide forever, it seemed like. And so Carrel said, we are mortal because we are multicellular. And if we could only unleash the immortality that's intrinsic in our own cells, we could live forever. He was crazy. He really was crazy. And so Len Heifler comes along and he says, no, cells don't divide forever in culture. And it turns out that Alexis Carrel's experiment was flawed. He was refeeding his cultures with new cells and he didn't realize it. And Len Heifler was absolutely right. And when he made that discovery, he made two very prescient speculations. The first was, my goodness, cancer cells don't do this, so maybe this is an anti-cancer mechanism. It turns out he was completely correct. The second was, my goodness, these cells look kind of old and ragged. Maybe this has something to do with aging. And he's probably also right. And so that set the stage then for two groups of biologists to begin studying this process, which he termed cellular senescence, cancer biologists and aging biologists. And it's only recently that they've begun to talk to each other.
And Judy, just following up on the sort of the cell type question, I mean, senescence as a function of the type of cell, what about senescence in non-dividing cells?
Great question. So the cells that undergo senescence are cells that have the capability of forming a lethal tumor. So that's the cells of your skin and your gut, and your breast, prostate, lung, you know, all those organs that get cancer. It's the dividing cells in those tissues that have the capability to undergo senescence. There are cells in your body that will never form a tumor. Mature neurons will never form a tumor. People think that's not true because we have tumors called neuroblastomas, but they don't come from mature neurons. They come from the precursor cells to neurons. The same thing with muscle. Mature muscle will never form a tumor. And so the question is, do these cells undergo a senescence process? We don't think so. We think that when those cells are damaged, they're much more, they're primed to die rather than to undergo the kind of changes that we see when a cell that's in danger of becoming a cancer cell undergoes senescence. But it's still an open question. It's still something that we're interested in studying.
But it also leaves open the possibility that these cells could be affected by dividing cells. For
yes.
example, neurons in the brain are surrounded by dividing cells.
Correct.
As is muscle. And so factors which are being secreted, and you talked about that a little bit earlier, could influence these non-dividing cells in deleterious ways. Do you want to talk about the SASP?
Yes. Yes. So that is a major hypothesis. So when a cell undergoes senescence, as I said, it begins to secrete lots of molecules, and we call this secretion the senescence-associated secretory phenotype, or SASP. Now, One disclaimer, we call it senescence-associated, not senescence-specific, because it is associated with cellular senescence. But in fact, what we are realizing now is it's a more generalized response to damage. So many types of damage, even damage that doesn't quite cause senescence. So for example, cancer cells, which have overcome senescence and they're proliferating, but they're damaged, they're secreting like crazy. And these molecules that they're secreting can travel throughout the body. That's our hypothesis. And they can affect distal tissues. So we call this the damage at a distance hypothesis. The idea is that aging in one tissue might accelerate the aging in a distal tissue. And so what we see with aging, we very rarely see one tissue aging and other tissues not. It's usually a large-scale systemic decline, and this might be one of the mechanisms that drives multi-tissue aging, which is what we recognize as old age. We lost Mark.
Jules, work. Hello, can you hear me?
Oh, now we've got you back.
See, this is, I'm the one who's in Cleveland and you guys are at the cottage. This is fantastic. I'm going to take that question to the next level and say, how do these molecules carry on their role in SASP. And mitigate aging in distal tissues. But before I do, I'm going to take a minute to thank one of our sponsors, Kaleidograph, for sponsoring Futures in Biotech. Kaleidograph is a thoughtfully designed graphing and data analysis application for research scientists, business professionals, and engineers. Produces publication quality graphs. Easily converts most complex data into a functional display. statistics, linear, nonlinear curve fitting. By the way, I use it for nonlinear curve fitting on a day-to-day basis. It's part of our workflow and our data analysis from our cell-based assays. It's great stuff. It has the ability to produce precise graphic visualization of data. All these things make cladographic powerful and flexible. Since 1988, cladograph has been an easy-to-learn graphing and analysis program at a surprisingly affordable price. Try cladograph for 45 days risk-free. And purchase cladograph then within the next 60 days, and you'll get a 20% discount if you purchase. So visit www.synergy.com/podcast.htm for more details. As I said, I use it. It's great stuff. It's really probably the best curve fitting software out there, the most powerful in that you can manipulate the equations. They give you a whole bunch of equations, but you can manipulate them to really match the model that you're trying to curve fit. And they do a great job. So visit www.synergy.com/podcast.htm. So you've got senescent cells, let's just for simplicity's sake, in your toes. They're senescent. They're releasing, they're going through a process called SASP, which is senescence-associated
secretory phenotype.
and they're releasing molecules. Are these small molecules?
Yeah. In general, they're small proteins. And they are proteins that are known to cause what we call inflammation. So inflammation is a response. It's a body response that is absolutely essential for life. So when you have an invading organism, a little worm or a little tick or even a virus that comes into your body, you mount an inflammatory response to fight off that pathogen. So that's pathogen-driven or germ-driven inflammation. What happens with aging, though, is that you get what has been termed sterile inflammation. There's no sign of an invading organism, but the tissue is filled up with cells that act as though they're trying to fight off an invading organism. So why is that bad? It's bad because when you do have an invading organism, the immune system is primed to kill that invading organism. So immune cells will release toxic molecules and attempt to kill something off. If you have these immune cells infiltrating your tissues without an invading organism, you'll have tissue destruction for no good purpose. And so it turns out that senescent cells, a lot of the molecules that they secrete are the types of molecules that would mount a kind of low-level inflammatory response. And we think this may be part of the problem. This may be why they drive the aging process. So these little molecules get into your bloodstream, in your toe, and they travel up through your veins and your arteries, and eventually they reach your brain, and you have neurodegeneration. That's the hypothesis anyway.
Following up on that, Judy, I mean, you've got these senescent cells accruing with age. How can you tell a senescent cell is there in vivo? I mean, in a dish is one thing, but how can you tell that they're really there in aging organisms, including human beings?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's been asked by us and by other people. And we know they're there because senescent cells express special proteins that allow us to detect them. They express an enzyme, which has been termed senescence-associated, beta-galactosidase. They often express a major protein, tumor suppressor protein called P16, which you can detect with antibodies and tissue culture slices. There's a number of markers that we can, in the aggregate, stain a tissue for and then have pretty good confidence about whether a cell is senescent or not. I do want to point out there's no specific marker. There's no one marker that says this cell is senescent. But if you use three or four markers, we can be pretty sure that they're there. And they are there. They do go up with age. They go up with age in mice. They go up with age with people. And they just go up faster in mice than they do in people.
In one of your publications, you have a list of like 80 right now.
a list of what? Of
80 markers?
Oh, those 80 are what's being secreted.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
so this isn't a simple biological process.
It's a very
process.
Complex phenotype. That's right. So they're secreting a lot of different molecules that we think in the aggregate will be deleterious over time. So one thing we'd love to do is to be able, I mean, here's a question you should ask.
<That's okay.
laughs> Where was the Thank intelligent you. Designer in all of this? Why?
No controversy here.
This is California. Okay. Why would an organism evolve a mechanism that has this downside late in life when it had a perfectly good initial mechanism for suppressing cancer, which is this programmed cell death or apoptosis, right? If all we needed was every time a cell is in danger of becoming cancerous, that cell were programmed to die, we wouldn't have this problem with senescent cells, right? So it turns out we're beginning to learn that there probably is a benefit to having cells undergo senescence instead of death. And that benefit is senescent cells are able to communicate with the neighboring cells within the tissue and let the tissue know there could be a problem. The senescent cell got there by virtue of some kind of damage, and it's communicating with its neighbors that there is a problem. And so the tissue becomes primed for, say, wound healing. And we now know, there's at least a couple of reports, that senescent cells present at the site of a wound help the wound heal more efficiently. So there is that good side. If it's true that there's this short-term benefit of having a senescence response, then the question is, how does that response get turned off? Because you can't have chronic wound healing. That would become pathological. And it turns out that senescent cells also call in the immune system to destroy themselves. So this senescent cell gets damaged. It's senescent. It's secreting. Part of those secretions call in the immune system. The immune system then attacks the senescent cell and tries to kill it. So we've learned recently that that process works pretty well. But again, it's not perfect. And some senescent cells escape the immune system. And we think these are the ones then that build up with age and are causing this chronic inflammation and chronic tissue destruction. So again, we're still testing all the parts of these hypotheses, but in a way it makes sense. So now the challenge is, well, how can we make, either we want to make the immune system more efficient, kill off those last few cells that they're missing, or find some miracle drug that will cause senescent cells to die instead of sitting there and secreting. And we don't, obviously, we don't have any tools to do that yet, but it certainly is a major goal.
One thing I find really interesting is that your studies on the fundamental mechanisms of senescence are, you know, have, by studying the biology of senescence, you're learning a lot about, you know, disease or cancer and well, the fundamentals of life, but also mechanisms for the development of cancer and the offshoot of your work, even though it's not the direct area of your study, is sort of leading to for tremendous amounts of information that could be recruited or by people that are going to translate that to clinic.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm wondering if there's like 80 markers, 40 to 80 markers of compounds that are secreted during senescence, and senescence is at times beneficial, would there be a diagnostic tool that could detect specifically those 40 to 80, or are there several markers out of there that are the most prominent? You don't need 40 to 80, but maybe you had a chip that could recognize the 10 most prominent ones
with
a high sensitivity. Could you use it as a diagnostic tool?
It's possible. It's possible. It's possible.
I actually want to touch on something Mark just briefly mentioned.
Sure.
And that's this straddling between two worlds, which you do so well. I mean, your research is both on cancer and on the basic biology of aging, and you're leveraging insights from one to maximize insights into another. And can you talk a bit about that as an approach for understanding the biology of aging and in fact developing therapies for diseases associated with the biology of aging?
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, I think this is the beauty of science, is you start off, you know, in one corner of the world or a universe of your field, and if you follow the data, just follow the data, you don't know where you're going to wind up. So I started off studying cancer and wound up studying aging. I didn't plan it that way. But I think one of the things we've learned, and I think one of the things that biologists in general have learned, is how interconnected different biological phenomena are, and how at the center of it all really is the biology of aging. I think we've learned as much about cancer from studying aging as we learned the other way around. And the more I delve into this, the more I'm convinced that by studying aging, we're getting insights into diseases that, as diverse as neurodegeneration and a cancer, which are very, very different types of diseases. But it really says that the basic fundamental processes that drive aging are driving probably 99% of the diseases that are seen in the clinics in developed countries.
Do you want to take it up a couple of levels in terms of the priorities of funding? This is one of the interesting areas.
I know.
Which is a lot of people in the biology of aging are aware of, but I'm not so sure is well known outside of that specialty, is how the National Institutes of Health in particular structure the funding with regards to disease and the diseases which really arise as a function of aging.
Yeah. So there's a National Institute on Aging, which is not a very large institute. It's not the smallest, but it's by no means the largest. And there are huge institutes like Heart, Lung, and Blood and Cancer, the National Cancer Institute. And within the biology of aging, there's this very deep awareness of how the basic processes that drive aging are responsible for setting the organism up to get these other major diseases like cancer and heart disease and neurodegeneration. It doesn't flow the other way very easily. So I give lots of talks to cancer biologists, and I say to them, you know, cancer is a disease of aging. Oh, yeah, it takes time. That's why. No. There's real biology that's driving this disease, and it's the same biology that's driving neurodegeneration. I think there really needs to be a greater awareness of how fundamental the aging process is, especially now that we're having a national debate on what to do about the aging baby boomers and all of the chronic diseases that they're going to experience. I don't understand why.
We've got about a 1 second delay right now. Oh. So this is Skype. I apologize for the interruption. They joked about this on Jon Stewart last night. I want to ask you the question about, I wish I could edit. In terms of funding, this is such a fundamental, it's the most fundamental aspect of life is that it can end, right? Mm-hmm. And then we've been dreaming about, eternal life and policy, people have really, how do you put this? It's always been a pipe dream, but now we're looking at biology that can improve outcome, lifespan, in a way that is the next stage from antibiotics, right? When antibiotics came in, when you learned how to use soap, infections decreased, that extended lifespan. We learned how to use antibiotics. When vaccines came about, the lifespan in steps kept increasing. And now the research that you're doing, if it elucidates fundamental processes that can be controlled and regulated through pharmacological approaches or through gene therapy approaches.
In theory.
In 50 years, though, it might. And so I guess there's always been a fear of or a misunderstanding of the whole life and death issue. And it's essential. I mean, it's an essence of our human existence. Right.
Well, it is.
Nobody wants to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Let's distinguish between two things, death and aging. So, of course, nobody dies of good health, right? So the aging process is a process that, of course, in the end will kill you, but it also decreases the quality of life. So I think there's good reason for optimism that there will be drugs, pharmacological interventions down the road that's going to improve, as I said, health span, that is, the years of healthy life. Whether we will ever have a drug that will improve lifespan to any significant extent, now we're not talking about adding 5 years or 6 years at the end of life, we're talking about really large differences in lifespan, what evolution did when it leapt from mice to humans and there was a 30-fold increase in lifespan. We don't know. We really don't know if that's possible. And I think it's important to distinguish between those two possibilities. One is intervening in the decline, the multi-system decline that we recognize as aging, and the other is forestalling death, increasing lifespan to some significant degree. So I think we're well on the way to doing one where we still have major, major questions as to whether it will be possible to do the second.
One thing I'd like to ask you is, a lot of the science in aging that we focused on Futures in Biotech is the screen for biological pathways, whereby an important single gene or just a handful of genes by modulating their activity could greatly extend lifespan in certain model organisms. Mm-hmm. And my question to you is that on the one hand, they're making discoveries that are sort of leading the way to, by understanding how those genes work, give an elucidation on the aging process. I want to know how you use those models to better understand senescence and some of the biological processes that mediate or that are sort of in between senescence and cancer. But before we do, I do have to thank our second sponsor. And so if I can just do this for a sec, I'd like to take a moment to thank MailRoot for sponsoring Futures in Biotech. MailRoot is a secure, hosted service that filters virus and spam for companies of any size. Whether you're a single user or a company with tens of thousands of employees, MailRoot can eliminate virus and spam, reduce your load on your email servers, lower your costs, and make email usable again. Typical MailRoot customers see 95% reduction in their inbound email volume and virtually no false positives. By the way, back in 2006, I submitted my first NIH grant, and the NIH was moving to electronic review process, and they sent me, there was some errors in the how I filled out the forms. I used PI, principal investigator, instead of PI/PD for project director. And they sent me the email response in triplicate, and the Yale spam filter deleted those notifications, and it cost me three months on a $600,000 grant that was awarded. But so I basically had to wait for that $600,000 for 3 months. It was a dramatic effect on my life. Could not start the company until that happened. So spam filtering is a really, you know, it's a really great tool if it's done right. And MailRoot does it right. They do it so right that Leo Laporte, our chief twit, has been using it on his domains for 6 years, and has been his top choice for spam and virus filtering all along. Tom Merritt also has been using MailRoot. Now he can use email domains that he hadn't been able to use for a long time. Tom Johnson, who's the founder and CEO of MailRoot, started one of the very first companies in the market in 1998 called FrontBridge. And FrontBridge was acquired by Microsoft in 2005 and is still offered as Microsoft Exchange hosted services line. Tom wasn't done, though, and he had a lot of good ideas that he didn't want to see go to waste. So he started MailRoot, his next generation service for filtering email, with a level of accuracy and price that's unmatchable. There's nothing easier than filtering with MailRoot. There's no hardware or software to install. You just sign up with MailRoot, change your MX records for your domain, and start your mail flowing through them, and they'll do all the work for you. Visit MailRoot.info to sign up. That's just a TWIT listener link. Okay, so it's a secret. Shh. you'll receive 10% discount for life. For the entire life of your account. Small business accounts start at $2 per user per month for 10 users. And because of demand from the Twit Army, MailRoot has added a new service for individual users as well, less than $30 per year for a single user. Visit MailRoot.info and sign up for the email filtering service that both Tom Merritt and Leo Laporte use. We thank them for the support of Futures in Biotech. So the question that I asked, I guess it was a fairly complicated one. It was... how to use, people have been studying, they've identified a handful of genes that can greatly extend the lifespan of organisms that they've been studying. How are you using those models to understand the biological mechanisms that you're studying? That great is at question. The nexus of cancer and senescence.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I guess part of the reason why we're pretty convinced that the process of cellular senescence is linked to aging and possibly lifespan in higher organisms like mice and humans, is because some of the same genes that can be tweaked to extend the lifespan of, say, little worms or even fruit flies, those genes exist in human and mouse cells. And we now know that some of those genes are important for how senescent cells behave. So, for example, there's a very ancient pathway which is called the TOR pathway. It's present in yeast. It's present in little worms, fruit flies, mice, humans. And tweaking this pathway, tuning it down, has been shown to extend lifespan. In fact, you've probably heard that you can extend the lifespan of many organisms by restricting calories. And it turns out that this TOR pathway is very important for the lifespan extending effects of caloric restriction. This pathway, it turns out, is also important for driving the senescence-associated secretory phenotype. And we've recently discovered this. So they're linked. All these pathways are linked. And they're very ancient pathways. And this is part of the reason why we're convinced that the senescence process is also part of mammalian aging, just as these ancient pathways are part of the aging process of these lower organisms. And by the way, we can extend the lifespan, we biologists can extend the lifespan of very simple model organisms, but the more complex an organism is, the more difficult it becomes to really extend the lifespan. So we still have a lot, as I said, we have a lot of open questions and a lot to learn about lifespan extension. Health span, I think, is something that is something that we're going to be able to tackle more reasonably and more contemporarily.
Yeah. Following up on that, Judy, I mean, just touching on what you said, I mean, this is one thing which I think in the field we kind of get caught up in the magnitude of the numbers with which we can extend lifespan of these simple model organisms. It's relatively routine now to double, triple, quadruple lifespan of nematodes. But when you look at those same manipulations in mammals, it's much more modest, you know, 10%, 12%, 15%. So, I mean, I think the record in worms now is a tenfold increase in lifespan.
That's right, tenfold,
which is, you know, humans 1,000 years old. Maybe this is where Aubrey de Grey gets his numbers from. I don't know.
But are these models resistant? Are these mice, even though they're 10%, I mean, if they're 10%, they live 10% longer. How about their condition? Can they put off cancer for? Are they healthier?
It's interesting. Their lifespan is extended. It depends on the manipulation. So some of these mouse models, their lifespan is extended, and in fact, nobody knows why they die. They don't die of any major overwhelming pathology. Many of them still get cancer, but the cancers tend to either be less aggressive, so they tend not to end life, or fewer numbers of tumors in an animal. So it varies a lot. But I think some of the more successful interventions that have extended lifespan in a complex organism like the mouse have also been able to extend the health span of those animals. So if you take a 2-year-old mouse that is untreated and a 2-year-old mouse that has been manipulated, one of these pathways has been manipulated, you know immediately which one is manipulated because the animal just looks, it's moving faster, it looks healthier and happier. And
yeah, caloric restriction would be a good example there.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
The implications are just awesome. And in terms of health benefits to those people that might have a predisposition for the early onset of age-related disease, right? If you have a predisposition to Alzheimer's or diabetes or age-related diabetes or cancer, this seems like and that's most people, I suppose. I mean, to an extent.
Well, we've all got good genes, right? And bad genes, right? Unless you're really, really unlucky.
One question I'd like to ask, and this again is back to senescence. How does senescence differ in terms of its effect at tumor suppression early in life and late in life? And how did that come about, evolutionary speaking?
You mean evolutionarily?
Is senescence important? I mean, early in life, does it have benefits early in life that don't translate late in life? I mean, we covered this a little bit, but I didn't seem to get a really good grip of it. And how would have that come about?
So let me give you an example. There's a very powerful tumor suppressor gene called P16, INC4A. And this gene is very important. It tells cells when, I'd like to edit that. Okay. this gene is important for locking in a senescent cell into a state where it cannot divide again. So it's very important. There are people who have a mutation in this gene. They're born with one bad copy of this gene. And mice have been engineered where they have two bad copies of this gene. So what's the outcome for these people? Do they live longer because they no longer have this senescence locking mechanism? The answer is no. They die of cancer. They die a premature death due to cancer. So senescence is important early in life. It's one of the ways that the body has evolved, our genome has evolved, to ensure that we don't develop cancer at a very young age. Now, remember, evolution cares mostly about what happens to you while you're reproductively fit, while you're able to have babies. So these mechanisms all evolve for the purpose of allowing this major pathology, cancer, which could be devastating and could curtail reproduction, to postpone it long enough that reproduction can go on optimally. It's later in life that the trade-off between having this mechanism and not having cancer becomes apparent. And so this idea of an evolutionary trade-off is really rampant throughout biology. Evolution has had to make some compromises in the way it's optimized organisms for reproduction. And we think that senescence is one such example of an evolutionary trade-off. So we need it when we're young. We probably also need it when we're old, but it's less effective, and we think it can then turn around on its head and start driving pathology.
I mean, that's also exemplified. I mean, what Judy just described is called antagonistic pleiotropy.
Yes.
I want to give technical. That's exemplified by the natural lifespan of organisms in a
yes.
sense as well. So in a lab, mice can live 3 years because they're protected from the environment and everything else. But in the wild, mice only live three, 4 months.
Yeah.
So there's a tenfold decrease in the natural lifespan of organisms from the protected sort of urban area as opposed for human beings. I mean, I think the data is not great, but our natural lifespan is probably somewhere around 30 or so. But now we can, of course, live a lot longer because we can protect ourselves.
So. Well, yeah, we've done away with predators. Most of our, I think the only predators left are ourselves. We have all the food we need. We're
too much.
Too much food, that's a problem. And infection. You know, being able to conquer infection. It's another thing we do for our mice. We put them in an animal colony and they're protected from infection. That's a major cause of death in the wild for mice. And it certainly was for humans for much of our evolutionary history. So we're reaping the benefits of our large brain, which has allowed us to control our environment. But again, there are limits, and there were trade-offs that we're now seeing the downside of. And this is, of course, what aging research is all about.
Do you think, Judy, just this point about this lab environment versus the wild, do you think it's important to look at the biology of aging in the context of a range of environments? Because what we may find in terms of interventions in the lab may not be generalizable to a more stressful environment, for example.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I will say that our lives, are more like the laboratory mouse than the wild mouse. I mean, we're not out there fending for our food and, you know, keeling over with rampant infections. So in a way, I don't think the laboratory animal is too far, too different from the way we're living our lives. But we do have more stress, that's for sure. I think we should make all of our mice write NIH proposals, and that would do it.
I suppose third world problems versus first world problems in terms of the immediate benefits to, you know, improving the health of our older population as the world gets older is important. But I think it's really critical not to forget the first world problems. Third world problem, sorry, that still need to be tackled. And, you know, malaria is killing millions prematurely, and hepatitis C, you know, which can be treated at least partially effectively. I mean, so I think it's important to note, just to note that there's still some third world problems that can lead to, that would need to be tackled.
But Mark, one thing we should remember, most of those problems are not problems of biology. We know how to prevent malaria. We know how to feed people. What we can't do is what we haven't been able to solve is the social problems that prevent us from getting those solutions to vast numbers of people in underdeveloped countries.
Absolutely. Organizational structures that can deliver, absolutely, the framework. Yeah. And there's some great initiatives going on, at least. Absolutely. Yeah, that's not if we have a vaccine some countries can't get it, then there's a great disadvantage. Now, that leads to the question, when the benefits of this science can improve the health of the older populations, it seems like there might be a tremendous economic and sort of social injustice that's added on top of those major problems that we already have. In the United States, Europe could benefit from this research. It's the question that will always, for example, if Sartre's drug actually has improves lifespan by 10%, and those people live healthier for those extra 10 years as well, so maybe even 20 years of better health, which is a dramatic contribution to the health of Americans and people who have access to those drugs.
Well,
how do we not give it?
How will you not?
Go ahead. How do you not just give it away for free to the entire world? I mean, I guess that's a fundamental pharmacology question.
It's really the same. It's really the same question as to why everyone doesn't have universal access to healthcare.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not a scientific question. That's a societal question. I mean, how many people in the third world get access to heart transplants or transfusions or anything else?
Yeah,
or antibiotics.
I mean,
anything.
Exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Believe me, if there were a biological way to ameliorate some of the suffering that goes on in first world, I think many of us would be working on it. But it's not a biological question. It's a social question.
Well, anyway, I really appreciate your approach, though, of studying these fundamental mechanisms of biology. And the offshoots are just incredible, I think. And the story is really fun.
Well, we hope so. We're working on it.
Simon, do you have any final questions? Like, is there stuff that we haven't covered here that we should really cover? Because, of course, you're really into, not really into, but you're really on top of the topic. And I don't want to fail our audience here.
the only thing which we haven't really covered, which is something which Judy's worked on over the years, is the role of telomeres in this and DNA sort of stability or genome stability in general. You maybe want to spend a couple of minutes talking about that, Judy.
Yes. Let me just define a few definitions. So telomeres are the ends of your chromosomes, tips of your chromosomes. And they're really important because nature abhors broken DNA. And if you think about it, it's very difficult to know where the end of a chromosome is as opposed to a break in the DNA. So the telomeres are specialized structures that tells the cell this is not a break in the DNA, this is a natural end of a chromosome, and therefore it gets protected. The telomeres get protected from inappropriate repair, because what a cell will try to do when DNA is broken is glue it back together again, and you definitely don't want that to occur at the tips of your chromosomes, because when the cell then tries to divide the next time, your chromosomes are all cemented together and they're going to get ripped apart, and then you really have massive damage to the DNA. So telomeres are crucial, crucial structures. What's interesting about telomeres is that because of the biochemistry of DNA replication, simple biochemical rules, there's no way to actually replicate up to the very, very tip. So every time a cell divides, those tips get smaller and smaller and smaller. And then eventually, it's no longer a proper structure. And now the cell sees that telomere as broken DNA. So if the cell is a healthy cell, a truly normal cell, it's going to become senescent as a result of that, because a broken piece of DNA, a broken telomere rather, is going to cause more genomic instability, and that's going to drive cancer. So telomeres are important anti-cancer structures, and cells will senesce when they have a bad telomere. What's become very interesting about telomeres is they've been described as biological clocks because they get shorter and shorter. People have postulated that you can learn something about the biological age of an organism by looking at how long their telomeres are. Very old people would have shorter telomeres. Very young people have longer telomeres. That's more or less true. It's not completely true because there are some cells that have a special enzyme that can repair the tips of the telomeres and make them grow. Actually, germ cells, sperm and egg, have to have that special enzyme. It's called telomerase. But more or less, it is true that the older you are, the shorter the telomeres. What that also means, though, is the older you are, the more senescent cells you have, because when the telomeres fail, the consequence is cell senescence, which is, of course, what we're studying, and we know why that's bad, right? So that's the telomere story.
It's amazing. It's all interconnected, and that's what I think is great about your work, is that you're interconnecting a lot of major biological pathways, and that's what makes it extremely difficult to really get a grip as an interviewer. Sorry, so I apologize if I didn't nail the interview this time. This was really fun, though, and what I'm going to encourage people to do is to go and look at some of the literature that some of the reviews that you've written. They're available if you link through through the website at the Buck Institute. Search for investigators and look for Judith Campisi, and then there's a long list of literature and some of the fundamental questions that you're asking are just the implications are just enormous. So I'd really encourage people to go and take a look at some of your papers. They're just really great place to start. And I really thank you for coming onto the show.
Oh, this was fun for me too. Thank you.
It's an honor and a pleasure, and I really appreciate you going to the cottage. You're the first guest from Futures in Biotech to be at the cottage. So congratulations!
We're having fun.
this is really cool for me. This is really, really cool to have a presence there. Our guest today was Dr. Judith Campisi. She's professor of the Buck Institute for Research in Aging. Thank you for coming on. I'd also like to thank Simon Melov. He's an associate professor at the Buck Institute for Research in Aging. He's been playing an important part in organizing these shows. So thank you for getting these going. And thanks for helping me out in the hard, more difficult parts. This is an area that is really, really hard because it's so global, so systematic in terms of biology. I like to focus on single genes at a time, and I have a hard time in putting it all in my brain. So thank you, Simon, for coming on. And thanks for making the trip up to the cottage.
Pleasure.
I'd also like to thank Chris Rebilo. I always have a hard time pronouncing her last name. Thank you, Chris, for helping produce the show. She's there in the background.
Yeah, she says thank you.
She's not on mic. She's there. I appreciate it. And we'll talk to get the last and the third part in this the mini series on the biology of aging. I'd also like to thank Bert McQuinn for handling the audio and video boards today and the recordings. I'd also, as well, Leo Laporte, Leo Kenzel, Frederic Louis, Eileen Rivera, Ken Shepherdson. Hey, we saw him for a second there. That was Bert. Ken Shepherdson, Tony Wang, Mike Taylor, John Salinina, John Stewart, Jeff Stewart, sorry, and Jason, and the rest of the team at the cottage in Petaluma, California. I'd also like to thank Phil Peltier and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can email me at mark, M-A-R-C, at twit.tv, or you can send a note on Twitter at mark, M-A-R-C, Pelletier, P-E-L-L-E, T-I-E-R. Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier.